The C.S. Lewis Podcast with Alistair McGrath.
Thank you for listening to the show that brings you the thought and theology of C.S. Lewis with me, Ruth Jackson. Discover more about Lewis by visiting premierunbelievable.com, where you can also find lots of great articles, resources, and podcasts. And you can also register there for the chance to win a free book. If you enjoy listening to the C.S. Lewis Podcast, please do consider rating and reviewing it. But now for today's show.
Well, I am absolutely delighted to be joined today by Michael Apizi, an independent educator, entrepreneur and writer based in Tennessee. He's got a master's in cultural apologetics from Houston Christian University, where he wrote his thesis on Lewis's book, Till We Have Faces, under Dr. Michael Ward. We're going to be talking about this book, among many other things, as well as sharing some of the context for a paper that Michael presented recently at the 2024 Undiscovered C.S. Lewis Conference, which was held at George Fox University. The title of Michael's paper there was Planetary Imagery Until We Have Faces. Michael, we're about to hear your paper from the Undiscovered C.S. Lewis Conference. Is there anything that may be helpful for us to have read before we listen to your talk? For example, is it necessary, do you think, to have read Till We Have Faces?
Well, your listeners may have to report back and let us know. I would think that this is a paper primarily directed at those who have read Till We Have Faces, who have internalized its at least, you know, fundamental structure, who have been frustrated by some of the tensions in the text. And I'd be curious to know to what extent my paper would be meaningful to someone who hasn't read Till We Have Faces at least once, but primarily directed toward an audience who's familiar with the book.
Yeah, that's really helpful, Michael. And do get in touch if there's anyone who is listening to Michael's paper, hasn't read Till We Have Faces, and has some interesting things to say about it. But what you're about to hear is Michael's paper from the 2024 Undiscovered C.S. Lewis Conference, which was held at George Fox University. And the title of his paper was Planetary Imagery Until We Have Faces.
All right. Well, hello, everybody. Pleasure to be here with you today. By a show of hands, who is at least roughly familiar with Michael Ward's book, Planet Narnia? Silly question. Keep your hand up if you've read it cover to cover, given it a good reading. Wonderful. Okay, good, because I'm assuming that you have. And for the rest of you, actually, there really aren't rest of you. It looks like everybody has read and become well acquainted with Ward. Maybe you've noticed that Ward's book, of course, is focused on the Ransom Trilogy, the Chronicles of Narnia. We've got 10 volumes there, and Lewis's poetry. What is Lewis's far and away best work of fiction?
Till We Have Faces.
Thank you, David. We can go home now. David's admitted it. Till We Have Faces is only referenced twice in all of Planet Narnia. Now, you know, Ward had a lot to work with here, so he doesn't need to go into Till We Have Faces, but the question remains, is there any imaginative logic of the planets in Till We Have Faces? Maybe, maybe not. I'm here to prove to you that there is. Let's jump right in. My theory is that Lewis did not suddenly cease to use planetary imagery after the last battle in 1956, but rather continues to employ it Until We Have Faces, which is published the same year. Prior to the publication of Till We Have Faces, Michael Ward has shown that Lewis made sophisticated use of planetary imagery in his fiction for at least 18 years. Longer, but at least 18 years. In the Ransom Trilogy and Chronicles alone, we have 10 volumes whose imaginative substructure consists in planetary symbolism. Is it implausible to consider that he may have continued to use planetary symbolism in his best and final work of fiction? So let me clarify, because this is very important. Till We Have Faces is not about planetary symbolism. In Andrew Laza's language, who's present with us here in the back row, Till We Have Faces is the myth of love. But Lewis uses planetary symbolism, I argue, in its orchestration. Symbols are of their nature never about themselves, but they're about something else. They're like joy, signposts pointing to something other and outer. Lewis told Carl F. H. Henry, the editor at the time of Christianity Today, that he would no longer be devoting his final years to apologetics proper, but rather to catching his readers unawares through story and symbol. And this is precisely what we find him doing Until We Have Faces. This is the story of love, but the symbols used are distinctly planetary. I theorize that each planet corresponds to at least one scene of importance in the plot. As we examine our literary high points for planetary symbolism, we should inquire a few things. Are there any logical or poetical problems present in the text that a cosmological hermeneutic would resolve? Leading question. We'll go over at least two. It'll also be worthwhile to trace how these planetary scenes develop the key themes of the book, love, and also self-knowledge. We'll take each planet as they occur in the narrative. So let's begin with Jove. Jove corresponds to Arul's coronation. In the discarded image, Lewis writes that Jupiter, the king, produces in men the jovial character. We must think of a king at peace, enthroned, serene, cheerful, festive yet temperate, magnanimous. On the night that Arul becomes queen, she enters the monarchical station of Jove. She writes, and keep in mind as I read Arul's words, Arul the narrator is an old woman, and Arul the character is a young and coming of age woman. She writes, "I had been happy with Psyche and the fox. Now, for the first time in all my life, and the last, I was gay. A new world, very bright, seemed to be opening all around me." And so Arul becomes gay on this night, something that she has never before experienced. Why? Does her new station cause her to be at ease characteristically? It's easy to be a queen with pagan nations that want to dethrone you and absorb you into their nation? No. It doesn't make sense. And also, this is a one-time event. Never before, never again. But this night, she's gay. And furthermore, why does Arul contrast rather than harmonize gaiety and happiness? I call this the problem of gaiety. By introducing gaiety in such a way, Lewis highlights the leisurely posture of Jove. A queen at rest, serene. The jovial spirit is festive, and so feasting is a jovial symbol, especially in a queen's court. That's what this has become tonight, the queen's court. They were all drunk by now, but their drinking had sickened me less than their eating. The gobbling, snatching, belching, the greasiness of it all. And yet, lest we imagine Arul herself to be intemperate, because temperance is also in the jovial nexus here. She adds, "That night's banquet was the first I'd ever been at and the last I'd ever sat through. After this, though I gave many feasts, I never did more than to come in three times and pledge the most notable guest, and then out again." And magnanimity. To showcase her magnanimity, Arul pardons Bardia, who asks leave. His wife goes into labor, and rather than impaling him there on the spot for daring to leave her on the night of her coronation, she gives him her choicest ring. "Here, give this to Unget for the safe delivery of your baby." And so we have a scene which is thoroughly jovial, Arul's coronation. And now for Mars, that's why we're here. That's what this paper began as, actually, and with the conference committee's blessing expanded. Lewis writes of Mars that Mars makes iron. Mars gives men the martial temperament, sturdy hardiness, the wife of Bath calls it in Chaucer. Martiality permeates the book atmospherically. You may argue that it's the most, very ironically, perhaps the most present planet. Psyche, so again, right now I'm arguing for a martial atmosphere. Psyche is bound in irons. To a tree being a symbol of Mars Sylvanus, and of course iron, the metal of Mars. The words cruel are repeated many times in the book. Fox implores Arul to persuade by reason and not bring a mercenary army to her aid. Passions. Phallic imagery abounds. The priest is referred to as a weaponed man. That's one of our references in Planet Narnia, one of two, to Till We Have Faces. Michael Ward finds that the most fitting description of martial imagery doesn't come in Out of the Silent Planet or Prince Caspian, but you guessed it, Till We Have Faces, a weaponed man, a non-eunuch male. Arul trains constantly with flats and then sharps with Bardia, and then approaches Psyche on the mountain with a dagger hidden beneath her cloak. Mars is hard. Hardness is an accidental property. How do you symbolize that? How do you symbolize something which doesn't actually have concreteness? Consider how frequently stone appears Until We Have Faces. Ungot is made of stone. The pillar room is made of stone. Arul entraps the well with stone. Ungot's house is built of great ancient stones, twice the height of a man and four times the thickness of a man. And notice the stones here, they're not measured with cattle, not with cubits, they're measured with men. Ungot's house is thrice described as very ancient, as Ward writes in Planet Narnia. Mars's antiquity is part of its masculinity. Lewis employs Mars not only atmospherically, as we've just established, but also in Arul's character development. In a hard atmosphere, again, influence, right? Planetary influence. If you're born under Mars, you are hard like Mars. If you're born under Luna, you're a lunatic. In a hard atmosphere, Arul hardens like Mars, especially after Psyche's exile. Following that fateful night on the mountain, Arul writes that she wanted hard things now. Hard things. To pile up knowledge and more that strength hard and joyless. By learning, fighting, and laboring to drive all the woman out of me. Arul does not simply become more self-deceived. She does. But she also becomes more masculine. Her outer martiality symbolizes her inner self-deception. But we must hasten and move on to Sol. Sol corresponds to Arul's complaint before the gods. The climax of the story. In this literary high point, hear how solar imagery abounds. I'm going to have to read more quickly so we can get through all seven heavens. So listen, keep up. I was walking over burning sands, carrying an empty bowl, white with sand to my middle, my throat rough with sand, unmitigated noon above me, and the sun so high I had no shadow. And I longed for the water of death. I walked for 100 years. I felt as if the flesh would be burned off my bones. I looked up at the sky and was nearly blinded, for the sun was still straight above my head. I had come, it seemed, into that country where the day never passes. Yet at last, though the terrible light seemed to bore through my eyeballs into my brain, I saw something. The scene is reminiscent, although entirely negatively, of the final scene of The Voyage of the Dawn Treader. Whereas Voyage approaches Aslan's country, Arul seems somewhere on the borderlands of Purgatorio. She's suffering. Sand up to her belly, unmitigated noon, heat that would burn the flesh from her bones, and terrible light that burned the eyes out of her sockets. And after 100 years of this purgatious desert journey, who does she meet? The piercing gaze of an eagle. A solar symbol for Lewis. He writes in The Planets, one of his poems, that Sol is beheld only of eagle's eye. And get this. This is cool. In a seldom noticed line of the discarded image, Lewis writes that Sol bears a likeness to arithmetic. It's frequently missed, and it's not referenced in Planet Narnia because it doesn't appear in the solar passage. It appears way later. Lewis kind of just amends it later on. Sol bears a likeness to arithmetic. It appears in the section on the liberal arts. As our eyes are dazzled by Sol's light, so our intelligence is baffled by the infinity of numbers.
the C.S. Lewis Podcast with Alistair McGrath.
We're going to take a quick break now, but if you are enjoying today's show, please do consider rating it and leaving a review on your podcast platform so that other people can discover it too.
The C.S. Lewis Podcast with Alistair McGrath.
Welcome back to the show. We would love to hear your thoughts and ideas. Do get in touch on social media at Premier Unbelievable. Now let's return to the conversation.
So in this scene, what happens? Aruel is dazzled by countless creatures all around her, both on the surface of the mountain and in the heart of the mountain. Seeing the mountain from the desert, she finds them crawling and alive with innumerable serpents and scorpions. Within the mountain, she's induced and surrounded by a vast assembly. There were tens of thousands of them. The very thought of counting them was tormenting. So the dazzling infinity of arithmetic enters into the symbolic nexus of soul. On to Luna. Luna's metal is silver, and men she produces wondering, including the wondering of the wits and lunacy. Luna corresponds to the night when Aruel thinks she hears the sound of weeping coming from behind the palace. It was very still. Most of the household was in bed. I thought I heard a sound of weeping. A girl's weeping. The sound for which always, with or without my will, I was listening. It seemed to come from without, from behind the palace. Instantly, crowns and policies of my father were 1,000 leagues from my mind. In a torture of hope, I went swiftly to the other end of the hall and then out by the little door between the dairy and the guards' quarters. The moon was shining, but the air was not so still as I thought. And where now was the weeping? Then I thought I heard it again. Psyche! Istra! Psyche! I went to the sound. Now I was less sure what it was. I remembered that when the chains of the well swung a little, there had been a breeze enough to sway them just now. They could make a noise, something like that. Oh, the cheat of it, the bitterness. I stood and listened. There was no more weeping. Time demands brevity, so let's list off the elements in the symbolic nexus of Luna. Night. Silence. At night, I mean, when the silence grew steep. The moon was shining. Confusion of senses. Water of the well. Oh, dry up, Jill. Dry up, Paul. Think of the silver chair. And the changing of one's mind. The temporary reversal of self-deception into proper self-knowledge. This is the only scene in which we are told that the moon shone, and we are told twice. Self-deception, or self-imposed lunacy, is overturned at night. When the silence grows deep, she runs out of the back parts of the palace, the hidden place. And there's a really cool echo here, and I don't have time to make the connection, so ask me later about the backside of the palace. Let's turn to Mercury. To understand Mercury, Lewis recommends that we take some real Mercury in a saucer and play with it for a little bit. That's what mercurial means. So Lewis gives priority to the physical characteristics of Mercury in understanding the character of the planet. It splits in two and quickly reunites once more, and perhaps you can already hear the echoes of this until we have faces. We're all limbs and parts of one whole, hence of each other. Men and gods flow in and out and mingle. Oh, I give thanks. I bless the gods. Then it was really I who bore the anguish. She achieved the tasks. Mercury corresponds to this scene, in which Aruel learns of Psyche's fate and her own participation therein. Aruel sees that though Psyche performs the tasks, yet Aruel bore the pain. A mysterious concept, no doubt. And in the end, just as God himself approaches, Aruel casts down her eyes. Two figures? Reflections, their feet to Psyche's feet and mine, stood head downward in the water. But whose were they? Two Psyches, the one clothed, the other naked? Yes, both psyches, both beautiful if that mattered now, beyond all imagining. Yet not exactly the same.
You also are Psyche, came a great voice. This swift episode of Mercury, dense with meaning, like Mercury itself. Dense with meaning and mystery, occurs in the elevated context of the gods' approach to Arul. This theme of unity and participation, perichoresis with God and man, runs throughout the story, even as we run in and out of one another. Venus, just trust me, she's there. We don't have time. It's the most obvious. We have to move on. Saturn. Finally, we turn to Saturn. Lewis writes, in the earth, he produces lead and men the melancholy complexion. In history, disastrous events. He's connected with sickness and old age, fatal accidents, pestilences, treacheries, and ill luck in general. He's the most terrible of the seven, in Fortuna Major. Saturn reigns over the act of treachery on the Gray Mountain, when Arul binds Psyche to betray her husband. And we must note that this deed of betrayal occurs on the Gray Mountain, gray being the color of lead, the metal of Mercury. Arul ascends this mountain for no other purpose than to commit treachery. On the hike, she writes that her heart felt as cold as earth and heavy as lead. Must also notice Arul's guide, Graham. Oh, I love Graham. Because he makes me... I'm right. And here's why. Why does Lewis write him into the story? We never get 10 words out of the guy. Is he some scarcely opaque placeholder? Inserted to allow Bardia away on some mission that will thicken our plot later on? No. Rather, Bardia seems to be taken out so that Graham may add his portion. But why? What is he at? I call this the problem of Graham. Graham contributes the melancholy complexion, a key effect of Saturn in men. He was a thin-faced man, very black-eyed, and I thought looked at me as if he feared me, touching me unless it was my fantasy as one who touches a snake or a witch. And also, oh, never mind. We are led by a Saturnine guide into a Saturnine place with a Saturnine name to observe a Saturnine heart, heavy as lead, whose hand commits the Saturnine act of treachery. Andrew Lazo is right. This is the myth of love. The heavens are symbolically used to set that love before our eyes. And the heavens are fitting symbols in the myth of love. Why? Why the planets? The planets are moved into motion by love himself in the Dantean imagination, the imagination Lewis so loved. In this image, love is the efficient cause as well as the final cause of the planets. And above deep heaven is God himself. In this light, Arul's Epic of the Soul reads much like Dante's. She journeys through the symbolic heavens to her final vision of God. Her journey is self-consciously to see her earthly beloved. Psyche is Arul's Beatrice. And yet, as she's transfigured into a repentant, self-knowing soul, a face unveiled with that word dug out of her, she is unmade and remade with desire to see God himself. I was pierced through and through with the arrows of it. The earth and stars and sun, all that was or will be, existed for his sake, and he was coming. Thank you.
That was Michael Apizi's paper, Planetary Imagery in Till We Have Faces, which was given at the 2024 Undiscovered C.S. Lewis Conference held at George Fox University. Michael, now that we've heard your paper, do you think there's any other helpful clarifications that you want to share?
Sure, yeah. It's been a few months since I presented that paper, and I've expanded on it and taken a couple of things out, trimmed it down a bit. It's hard to remember exactly what I have and hadn't said at this point. I would say that the thematic center remains love. The book is not about symbolism. If anything, symbols are inherently about something else. This is just a way that Lewis, I think, writes. I think that it does organize and orient some of his themes, the way that he develops his characters, the way that he even structures the plot. And I think that it does resolve some problems of the text, such as Graham, such as gaiety on the night of Rule's coronation, and Orient's themes such as perichoresis and the union of cells, for example, I think being related to Mercury. But yes, let the reader decide. Email me, tell me what you think, whether right or wrong. Let me know what you think.
And where can we go to find out more about some of the things you're up to? I know you're in the process of turning some of this stuff into a book at the moment, aren't you?
Yeah, I'm working on, so this was a prima facie case for the presence of planetary symbolism. That presentation had no time for talking about the meaning of that symbolism or, you know, 12 reasons to consider why it's fundamentally plausible that Lewis would use planetary symbolism until we have faces, or how the symbolism relates to theme and themes and all this other sort of stuff. Really just a prima facie case. I am working on expanding this into a book length project. We'll see if I make it in time for the coming up on the 70th anniversary of its publication. Yeah.
And you're working on a conference as well, aren't you, at the moment?
Yeah. I'm working with Andrew Lazo. He's a Lewis scholar that's currently, he was in Houston for years. Now he's down there in Winter Garden, Florida. He's an Episcopalian priest. He's a Lewis scholar of many years and really one of the best voices until we have faces. We've all been waiting on this book to hit the press, and I think that he's actually working on that right now. But yeah, working with him he'll be hosting the conference at his church in Florida. It'll be May 2nd through 3rd. The theme is Surprised by Love, and we'll be paying special reference to Surprised by Joy, The Great Divorce, and Still We Have Faces at that conference. And the call for papers is going to be going out very soon as well. Conference is titled Mere Christians, the Mere Christians Conference.
And with that call for papers, what is it you're after? And how does someone who thinks that sounds incredible get involved?
Yeah. So the call for papers is broad net. Anything really Lewis related that you can make a justifiable case for being tangential or related to that central theme of Surprised by Love. And then, of course, we do want these papers primarily to eliminate Surprised by Joy, The Great Divorce, and Till We Have Faces. But, you know, if you throw in some Silver Chair there as well, I don't think anybody would be too upset.
And where can people go if they want to submit an abstract for that paper? And is there a deadline on that as well, Michael?
Yeah, so I'm actually working on getting the call for papers out right now. It should be broadcast next week. And I believe we're saying that the deadline's going to be April 1st. Of course, the conference is May 2nd and 3rd, the first weekend there in May. Yeah, keep an eye out for it. You can also email me directly at michaellopezi@gmail.com. That's where the abstracts will be going for the call for papers. And I think Andrew has a page up on his church website. It's like a one-pager about the conference, Church of the Messiah, in Winter Garden, Florida.
Great. Well, I'll make sure that there's a link in the show notes as well, so people can just click straight on that. Well, Michael, is there anything else you want to say about C.S. Lewis before we finish up?
If you don't read them, read them. Lewis is wonderful. I keep waiting for myself to get bored, and I haven't yet. No, that's pretty much it. Thank you so much for having me on, Ruth.
Brilliant. Well, thank you so much for all your wisdom. Thank you for listening to the C.S. Lewis podcast with me, Ruth Jackson. Many of the topics that we've touched on today are discussed in greater detail on earlier episodes of the program. Check out our archive of past shows at premierunbelievable.com, where you can also find lots of great articles, videos, and podcasts. Plus, if you register on our website or sign up for our newsletter there, then you will get exclusive access to new content, free resources, and more. That's premierunbelievable.com. What did you think of today's show? Are there any topics or works of C.S. Lewis that you would like us to explore next? We would love to hear from you. Send us an email, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Connect with us on X, formerly known as Twitter, @premierunbelievablefe, or drop us a direct message on Instagram or Facebook @PremierUnbelievable. We have also recently launched on TikTok, so if that's your thing, or you know anyone else who might be interested, then you can find us there @premier.unbelievable. Your feedback and thoughts are so important to us, so please get in touch. If you're enjoying the C.S. Lewis podcast, please do consider rating and reviewing it on whatever platform you're listening on, as it helps more people to discover the show. Thank you for listening, and see you next time.